You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today it is with enormous pride that I bring you this interview with Alexei Sale. If you're British, you'll know who Alexei Sale is. I'm sure you will. And if you're not, it's hard to overstate his importance to British comedy. He was the very first compere at the British Comedy Store when it first started and ran the gong show there. He was sort of alone in being the only person who'd arrived and auditioned who was actually funny. Certainly in the first few weeks, until the rest of the people, as he will tell you, started to drift in and create what we now know to have been the real birthplace, the melting pot that created alternative comedy in the UK. He has a fabulous radio series currently called The Imaginary Sandwich Bar, and he's on tour with his stand-up show, and we're going to talk a little bit about how his character, his persona, has developed from the early days of the likes of Chertsey Belofsky from The Young Ones, and also the Who's That Fat Bastard of Alexei Sale stuff. If all of this is meaningless to you, just sit back, listen, and enjoy this conversation with someone who is really, has always been at the forefront for the whole of his life of a really genuinely political, absurd, and angry, righteously angry and very exciting comedy force. There is about 30 minutes of extras available to the Insiders Club, in which Alexei will talk about his real feelings towards Ben Elton and the current crop of arena comics. We'll discuss how he refit his show about political optimism when the political wind changed, and we hear a strange and wonderful link between stand-up and martial arts in terms of the relationship between the energy of the performer and the energy of the audience. That's all available now at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, but the rest of it is here for you all. This is Alexei Sale. Can we talk about energy and about the energy of your performance?
Certainly.
Because you are known, and I mean, I grew up on stuff. I was revising it, watching some old episodes on YouTube in preparation for this, and I was amazed by how much of it I could still sing along and, know the punchline at the ends of things. That was just exactly my era. And the name that you've made for yourself and your whole approach is all about attack, mm-hmm. and kind of instilling chaos. And mm-hmm. in Thatcher Stole My Trousers, you talk about hosting the store and imposing order on that really chaotic environment.
Yeah.
So how has your approach to chaos and the management of it changed over the course of the career?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's... I think you find a style that where whether if you're lucky or if you're talented enough, you find a style that works for you. So that kind of high energy attack works for me comedically. But also in the early days, it was obviously, as I said, the comic. I mean, there was only the comedy revolution, the revolution of British comedy would have happened anyway, but it wouldn't have happened in that place at that time without me, really, because I was the only person in Britain, really, who had the kind of complex set of attributes that would make that room work, which was that I was physically imposing, and I was, my act was aggressive. I was always honest, really. I think I was all But I was also, I had the kind of, the material, which was, you know, the kind of material that nobody had ever seen before. So, you know, those kind of, that collision of attributes made me work in that particular place. And then after that, I mean, it's just, it's not, I don't know that I really have a choice. I mean, I thought when I went back to doing stand-up in sort of gradually in 2011, 2012, that I might be a bit more, that the rage might have gone, maybe, but it just kind of, I mean, I think that there's probably more, there is more light and shade now. And the way that I know this is kind of, going further down the road, but I mean I stopped doing stand-up because, you know, I found I'd reached the limits of the guy in the tight suit, really, that because he was a comic persona, that he wasn't me, and therefore I couldn't really talk about my life. And then, and so the way that the new material evolved was through doing book readings and through doing Q&As and interviews and stuff. And that, you know, if you're at the Cheltenham Literary Festival, you're not screaming and shouting at the audience. So the material had evolved in a much more, when it was the same material, you know, when I did it at a book festival, it was much more laid back. But when I do it as stand-up, it just comes out much more high energy, really.
Do you think is the anger, the rage, is that something that is simmering all the time off stage, or is it something that you have to whip up when you're on stage, or is it something where the stage is an outlet for it?
Yeah, no, I think it's, I'm not particularly introspective about my own process, so, you know, I mean, but I think that, it's about, I have all these kind of, you know, enraged arguments in my head with people, you know, and so I suppose it's a way of letting those out, really. My act is, I mean, again, what interests me, it's funny, there was Linda, you know, looks at Twitter afterwards, really, people don't tweet much anymore about shows, I think, but on Saturday night, which was a really amazing show in Oxford, the Dean of Brooks University had been in and he'd really enjoyed it, but he said I was ranting about inauthenticity, really, I was ranting about inauthentic people. And I think that is true. I mean, what interests me as comedic fodder is partly, not exclusively, but it's partly hypocrisy, you know, inauthentic, you know, being inauthentic, really. I mean, that's what I tends to, not only that, because I just do a lot of stuff that's just silly, you know, but it's certainly what motivates me is rage about, yeah, and injustice and, you know, that good stuff.
I took a picture of rather than cut and paste it from the book, where you describe to someone what you do in your act to an older northern club.
Oh, right, yeah.
And
yeah,
you
yeah.
say, and it's one of those things where, you know, as a comic, if anyone says, "What do you do?"
Yeah.
It's very hard to kind of, for anyone to put it into words. And this is, you say, "Well," I replied, "basically, I talk about politics, social hypocrisy, of course, consumerism, the legacy of post-colonialism, the fissiparous? The fissiparous nature of ultra-hard left political groupings. But you have to be aware, if you can imagine it, this is all done with a great deal of physicality allied to a kind of surrealistic overview, evocative perhaps of the French situationists." And that is, I mean, that is exactly and precisely what you do. Or what certainly what you did. Is that still what you do?
Well, I should also point out that the kind of comedic thrust of that, I'm not
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I've cleared all the coffee out of that for the sake of analysis. I can only apologize.
I'm also just talking to somebody who is utterly uninterested. Yeah. I'm being extraordinarily pretentious in a cab, and he just says at the end, he says, oh, yeah, you're a patter merchant.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was brilliant. You know, Lenny Bruce. Well, you know, you're a patter merchant. That's what you do. You're not like a crazy legs act. You're not a special act.
Yeah, right.
You know, you are...
Front cloth.
You're a patter merchant, which I thought put me in my place. Mm. So
just that description of what you do, like that's definitely what you did.
Well, that's me. I mean, being pretentious.
Sure, but it is also accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. There is an element of the French situation that's in there. You know, that absurdity. Yeah. Looking at some of the stuff looking back at stuff online, Alexis Sales Stuff, your TV show in the 80s and 90s. The satire and absurdism at the same time, in a way that's just, it seems incredibly contemporary.
Well, good.
But I wonder, those twin things of kind of rage and surrealness, like silliness about the rage, the ability to be angry about something and yet make it silly.
Well, yeah, because I never wanted to just do, you know, there is a kind of comedian who just does, you know, one thing really.
Yeah.
You know, talks about, you know, whatever the fuck they talk about. And I just thought that's just limiting, really. You know, why not? What is truly delightful about comedy is when it takes off, really, when it ceases to be, you know, earthbound and becomes stupid in a way, just utter stupidity, and that's what I want to do as well. Really, I don't want to just be a patter merchant. That I'm also, you know, there's a lot of physical stuff in my act, and I mean, there used to be songs, and I used to go on tour with two dancing girls, and which was an interesting period. But also being silly is also about undercutting yourself, really. You know, there's a lot of comedians who take themselves tremendously seriously. And I am always saying, I mean, I have a certain set of beliefs, obviously. I have a certain set of that I am left wing, you know. But I mean, there's always a kind of, there's always an inclination in my act to mock my own beliefs, you know. And I think that's very important, because otherwise you're just a kind of propagandist, you know.
You talked in your act on Friday, when I saw the show, you talk about the kind of, the shows which are kind of based around tragedy. The sorts of stand-up shows are. I know there's a really delicious, I mean, I know there were people in from your promoter in the audience that night that you were sort of apologising to, going, I'm going to put the boob into an act. They're not your, oh no, one of them is your act.
Yeah. I think I had three of their acts.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
There we go.
But you were talking about those kind of, you know, you're doing this sort of act out of audiences going, oh, it was so tragic, we were screaming, we were, you know, clawing our ears until they bled because the tragedy, but that's not fucking stand-up comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the same time, without wanting to give too much away from the show, you talk about your regret at not being able to do a show about...
And also it's about, without giving too much away, it's about something genuinely horrific.
A scare that you then started booking a room at the Edinburgh Festival. Yeah. So what, just sort of talk about that. Is that one rule for you and one rule for everyone else? Or?
Well, it's, it's fucking clever what I do without wishing to, but that's fucking clever because it's a critique of that kind of, it's both, you know, it starts off as talking about something, you know, genuine, because everything I talk about in the show now happened to me genuinely, that I, you know, serious illness. Then it morphs into a critique of that kind of comedy, comedy in inverted commas, the critics love, which is about, doesn't have a lot of gags in it, you know, but which is about you know, terrible human suffering of various kinds, which is a kind of modern trend. But then there's also an implied, there's also a kind of implied critique of me in there, and in that I'm, yeah, just some kind of dinosaur that can't really get with that idea as well, you know, and my rage at it is also that. So it's, it, I mean, it, if it works, it works on a, on a number of levels, and I love that bit. I mean, I love that, but it's also, you know, it, it's very much a kind of, I mean, what, one of the things I like about comedians in general is that all the way we think is that something appalling will happen to us, and we will try and get 5 minutes out of it. I mean, I think, I mean, I think that the problem with a lot of those, I don't particularly want to mention names, but problem with a lot of those shows is they're not funny, you know? So it's whatever, well, it, it may be compelling theatre, but it's not fucking stand-up. Stand-up is about jokes every, about, or laughs every 20, 30 seconds, you know, that's what stand-up is. And to say, you know, yeah, well, kind of I've gone beyond stand-up is a, is a fucking insult, really, because stand-up is the hardest thing to do in the world, really. And, you know, even the, even, you know, the terrible old school guys, and, you know, if you can get those laughs, fuck, that's there's nothing harder than that. Yeah.
You know? When you talk about the old guys, the old guard who kind of existed, that kind of comedy circuit, the, mm-hmm. whereby the stock in trade was a lot of, you know, racial hatred and chicken in a basket for 8 quid.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. Do you, as you've got older in comedy, have you had a different sensibility of, like, recognising that if comedy is the hardest thing to do mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. then the people who were doing the thing that you helped burn down, mm-hmm. they had some kind of nobility?
I think so. I mean, I don't kind of go along particularly with that revisionist thing where you say, oh, yeah, I loved Tommy Cooper, or I loved, you know... I don't know. I can't think of anybody else really. So I mean, there's an awful lot of pretending to love those old school guys. I think that they, I mean, there are ones who, I think Monkhouse actually wasn't bad. I mean, I think that. But I mean, what I do think is that there's a kind of tragedy about those guys in that they're bright and they're generally working class, and you know, they were forced, because audiences wouldn't accept anything else, they were forced down a road of kind of misogyny. And I think they could have, you know, they could have been a lot better than they are, really, those. And yeah, I think, you know, we all go through the same indignities, you know, and there is a, I think there is an esprit de corps about comics, even if they are right-wing, that, you know, you've been through the same shit, really. I don't think they thought that about my generation, no, about me.
No, it wasn't reciprocated.
It wasn't, but probably now they do. I'm actually, somebody like Monkhouse did, he wrote to me, and Tarbuck as well wrote me a very nice letter. And
really?
Quite early on, yeah. Yeah, and they could see, Les Dawson could see, you know, see that we, that I was like them, really, essentially, that there are obviously differences in attitude and material and stuff, but a lot of it's the same stuff, you know, a lot of it's, whether you're Stuart Lee or, you know, one of those, you know, Ted, you know, somebody from the past, you know.
Ted Rogers.
It's all the same, it's all, you know, a lot of it's the same, you know, every painter uses canvas and paint kind of thing, you know.
Yeah. And do you, like, I the way I approach comedy is I'm so grateful to have discovered it in my life that I sort of regard it, and it's something people say, Sarah Millican has said this on the podcast before, about it's the trunk of the tree of everything she does is going in, the main bit is going into a room and doing stand-up.
Yeah.
I certainly regard it as, certainly in the early days of it, I felt like we're all in this gang together.
Yeah.
So I mean, I've discovered, I've been allowed into the secret club. We're all in the gang together. And then I suppose down the line you go, oh, not everyone feels like that. Not everyone shares my beliefs or approach or anything.
Yeah.
As someone who sort of started the gang.
Yeah.
In many ways. I don't really know what my question is. I'm just, like, Did you? There's a moment in your telling of the early days of the store where, like, part of the reason why you're the compere for the Gong Show is that there are no acts. There's no one who's any good. Yeah, you tell this story of Don and Peter Rosengard, kind of auditioning acts and gradually getting more and more panicky because their concept isn't going to work because there are no acts.
No, no.
And then when people start to come along, you talk about Nigel Planer and Peter Richardson turning up, that you're like, oh, that's an act.
Yeah, Tony Allen, Keith Allen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Andy Del Toro, Jim Barclay, Pauline Miller.
Did you have a sort of a nascent sense of this is the gang, we're all on the same...
Yeah.
We've all discovered the same secret.
I mean, before the Comedy Store opened, I had been... Me and this other guy called Bill Monks, also a Liverpool actor, was in the Commons Party. We had this little show that we did, and it was directed by a friend of mine called Cliff Cocker, who I'd been in school with. He was also in the Commons Party. And we took this show around, wherever we could, really. And it was kind of a sketch show, but I would also step out and do, what was essentially stand-up monologue at the audience. And that was a piece from that show that I took for my audition for the Comedy Store. But we knew nobody. We didn't know a fucking soul. We didn't know anybody. It was just me and Bill and Cliff flogging around this. And we didn't know how to get to know anybody, really. But I always had a sense that if only I could find other people who thought as I did about comedy, then everything else from that point on would be fine, really, which essentially it was. And so I was, as soon as I saw the advert for the Comedy Store, I knew that was the case. Then, in fact, those people didn't turn up for a few weeks. I think Tony Allen was the first one, and maybe Keith. So, and then Rick and Aid and Peter and Nash and so on. So at first they weren't there, but I knew intuitively. I knew that I had to find other people because I couldn't do it by myself, that I would just continue to, circle. And it's also, I was very lucky in terms of time, and there's a guy who I like a lot called John Dowie, who was, me and Cliff and Bill went to see in about 1976 at the Bush. And he was very influential. I thought, and again, he was doing a kind of prototype alternative comedy. And I thought, this is kind of what I want to do. But he came too soon, he didn't know anybody out there. And by the time our thing had happened, he kind of got left behind by it, so... Mm. I think I knew that this was the time as well, kind of somehow, intuitively. One of the things about talent is that stuff that is not apparent to other people is apparent to you. You know shit. You can see, you can intuitively see what needs to be done, really.
And talking of your intuition, there's a moment in the book where someone says to you, you're different. And you go, oh, am I? And they go, you are different. Don't pretend you don't know who you are. What is that difference? What is it that you feel is or was or still is different about you?
Well, it partly comes from...
And I'm asking you to really pick yourself up here. Yeah, I realise it's sort of odd question to ask someone, but
I don't necessarily have a problem with that. it partly comes from background. I mean, that I've got a particularly unique kind of background in many ways. Obviously, parents in the Communist Party were also a very Jewish, I think, household. And partly it's just kind of wiring, I suppose, in a way. It's also, I don't know if I say it in the book, but somebody said to Linda, because I had, after I left art school, I had years of these shit jobs, like just filing clerk. Some of them, and I talk about like working on the Jubilee line and digging the Jubilee line and shit like that. And somebody said to Linda, and I don't even know if it was kind of, they'd worked with me in some office when I was just, I must have been about 25 or something, I was doing the filing. And they said, your husband is the strangest person because he doesn't have a kind of office face and a like an on-off. His face, he's the same person. Everybody else is a different person at work to what they are outside work. And your husband is exactly the same. He doesn't make any allowances for being at work. And I think that kind of gets to kind of essence of my character that I didn't know that you should really, partly, but I just behaved. I mean, I was a terrible employee. I mean, I was awful timekeeping and, you know. I wasn't suited to the world of work at all, like, as most comics are. But, I mean, I was always the same, really. And I'm very odd. I was lucky to find Linda as well, because Linda, I mean, I was much odder before Linda kind of got hold of me.
It's so sweet that you talk about her in the book and on stage. She's been there the whole time. How amazing to have someone who's kind of perpetually got your back throughout the whole of your career and travels with you when you talk.
Yeah, and she does. We do notes afterwards, you know, as well.
Yeah.
I've rarely been as nervous before an interview as this one, because Alexei was so important to me as a young person. And, we'll talk a little bit about that later on in the episode. But I just can't overstate the sort of, like, it was a proper meeting your heroes event. I hope I managed to wrangle this into an episode worth Alexei's stature and really invigorating intelligence, because I have to admit that your poor reviewer was a bit starstruck. I hope that doesn't come across entirely. I probably shouldn't mention it now in case it doesn't come across. But I absolutely loved meeting him and talking with Alexei. So there is more of this to come. Remember, at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, you can join the Insiders Club and get access to all of the extra bits from all of the shows that have them, including Alexei talking about the current crop of arena comics and what happens to his rage over time, whether there's any diminishing of that. There's a lot more stuff there, a good half an hour of stuff. So join up at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Alexei is on tour now. You can go to www.alexisale.me, that's M-E at the end, for details of his tour, or search Alexei Sale, because let's face it, even though I know how to spell it, I type it wrong first time every time. Alexeisayle. And in this context, .me. So all your tickets there for Alexei's tour. It is fast approaching sold out if it hasn't already. I think he's putting on extra dates, so get on that quick if you want to be in with a chance to see him. I know we didn't talk about this in the episode, but I was looking at his blog recently, and I know that Linda is very keen that they never tour again. So this may be your last chance. That's not any kind of an exclusive. That's just something that Alexei has said on his blog. So if you are a fan, really break your neck trying to get there, guys. I think you're really going to enjoy that show. I just want to thank Ellen Frost and everyone else at the Bloomsbury Theatre, and Tom Wateraker, who put me in touch with Ellen, for giving me very kindly the rehearsal space in which to record with Alexei. More in just a second. More now, and then I've got a bit of announcement at the end for you, plus our regular feature of people who've had their lives changed by the podcast. Semi-regular, occasional, just about one or two off. That's all coming up after the conclusion of this conversation with Alexei Sale.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Coming back to this idea you mentioned before, that there was a limit to what the man in the tight suit could say, which is when you stop doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
what sorts of things, like, is it the case that you then went away, wrote loads of books, did other things, said the things you wanted to say, and then could go back to stand-up? Or is it a case that you can say more now that you are the older man and no longer in the tight suit? You've kind of got those gears to draw on.
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes it... I mean, it wasn't a process. It wasn't without pain, really, that I... I mean, I'd always had an ambiguous, slightly ambiguous relationship with him anyway, which is probably just all my fucking mind. But, like, for instance, I would never meet the public, that I would always do a gig and then I would leave immediately. I never sold any merch or anything because I felt that they couldn't meet... I mean, this is fucking... love, it's stupid. But, you know, I felt they couldn't meet him, you know. And I also... I mean, I probably also... there was that contradiction that people would expect me to be him, really. You know, I'm very different person to the guy in the suit.
Sure.
But, you know, there was an expectation that way. And I always struggled, really, with that, with what that meant, really. And I suppose I mean, there's a lot of stuff I could have done. I think of myself in a sense as being sort of intellectual, you know, and so, and it's difficult for him to articulate that, really. And so, yeah, and I did a tour in 95 and it was okay, you know, it was fine. And then I toured Australia in 96. And then, you know, but I was singing songs. I had Bobby Chariot as well, who I'm tremendously...
I completely forgot about Bobby Chariot. As someone who has now done a decent bit of TV warm-up, Bobby Chariot is the patron saint.
Yeah, I mean, he was. I love Bobby. And he would... when did he come? He would come... we'd do, like, a slideshow thing that would break down, and then Bobby would come on. And then I had these two dancing girls and I would sing and dance. And it was like, but I was sick. And also times had changed. I think, you know, I think that I, again, this is my, you know, I think, you know, there is an enormous, I mean, I love going to comedy clubs where all the young comedians have to pretend that they're thrilled that I'm there, because I am such a... now have this kind of iconic status. Yeah. I don't know if I had that in, like, 98, 95, 96. I think people were thinking, who's this old, you know? I mean, you know, that this, you know...
all right, granddad, you invented comedy.
This isn't... you know, we want to do laddish stuff and...
yeah.
You know, all that, really. And we don't want to be yelled at about Marxism, you know. Gives a fuck, you know. You know, those hedonistic days of the sort. So I felt like I was out of fashion as well, which I think I was, you know, which is fine. So I just felt I couldn't... it felt hollow to me what I was doing, really. And so I stopped. And then you have to kind of think, well, what else am I going to do, you know? And that took a long... I mean, and then I becoming an author was really... I mean, I loved everything to do with publishing. I was delirious about being an author and stuff.
Because why?
Well, I love... because everybody's... well, everybody that... I mean, this was a kind of golden age of wasting money in publishing, so... but also, it's like... I mean, because you had, like... you're, like, in the music business, so I guess in comedy, you pay for, you know, you pay for the limos, you pay for the posters, you pay for... so when we, you know, when I was doing my first books with Hodger and Stout and Scepter, I would say, you know, am I paying for this? And they go, dear boy, no. No, you couldn't. We wouldn't dream that you would pay for these posts. No, this limo's... no, it's on the company, you know. It's... my dear, the very idea that you should...
yeah.
You know, and you'd get these lovely young people, like boys and girls, like in their early 20s, the kind of... publishing PRs, you know, just thought you were great, all these pretenders. And they were like really educated and really young and kind of optimistic, and they'd come round with you, you know, and you'd be up and down the country doing like travelling, staying in Malmaison and having like the two of you be like having, you know, the finest wines known to humanity to do a reading to 40 kind of loonies in a Waterstones in Nottingham.
That you can't get wrong because it isn't a gig.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, yeah.
I can't go back. Infinite prestige.
I am, well, also, I'm always going to be better than,
yeah,
than any, you know, than A.S. Byatt or, you know, I mean, I'm going to do a better performance than, you know, nearly anybody, really. So there was that as well. And everybody, oh, everybody just thinks you're great. And so it's just nothing to do with literature, really, but... And it was also, it was a way of dealing with more complex ideas. I think in terms of the fiction that I wrote and stuff, you know, it was, you know, I felt that, you know, the comedy that I was doing had limited, you know, possibilities in terms of the intellectual ideas. And so, but particularly with a novel, you can do... them. I mean, I was listening to a thing on the radio recently, a while ago, and Giles Fraser saying that. I can't remember what it was about, but saying really that the novel is the epitome of... The novel is the finest art form, in a way. And it's also the way... It's also the way that we... At its best, the way we explain... You know, the world to ourselves. You know, obviously, the great classic novels, I mean, something like War and Peace or, you know, Pride and Prejudice. I mean, you know, they, because you create this whole coherent world, and then within these worlds, ideas of morality are acted out, you know. So, you know, that was to be engaged on that, to be trying to do that was a tremendous... thrill, really. And then they kind of stopped paying for they stopped, you know, they stopped paying for you to go to Leeds.
Was that the industry changing?
The industry,
because there's no money in,
yeah, there's less money, yeah, yeah. And then I kind of fell out of love with it. Coincidentally,
was it seductive, the success and the trappings of success?
I mean, it was, and it was so, it was a wonderful contrast to the entertainment business, because everybody is so lovely. I mean, and they are, they're all white, they're all college educated, they come from a very narrow range of beliefs, so there's that as well. But for a while, you know, it was like a holiday, you know. Yeah, it was like a holiday, hiding from comedy, really. But it was a bit of a, I mean, in a sense, it was a true, I think in a sense I was denying my true nature, I think,
you know? Okay. Did it feel like you were sort of pulling a hustle?
Not a hustle, but I was probably too happy. You know, I'm never happy with being happy, really. So I was probably enjoying it too much, really.
Never happy about being happy.
Well, no, just, you know, I suppose it's. I mean, that's a bit, I mean, well, I just, you know, I mean, that, I mean, it, you know, it's always, I mean, doing comedy's always, you'd always, you particularly stand up, you're always right on the edge of catastrophe there all the time, really, even me. And so there's always that danger there, you know, as with, I think, you know, the idea behind, like, cognitive behavioural therapy is that you should never be too comfortable, you know, because seeking comfort is... because life isn't, really. And I sort of think, in a way, I don't know.
Go on. I'm interested to hear.
Yeah. And being an author, in some ways, was too comfortable, really. I suppose I did think as well, I came to think that, you know, when they had, and it's a kind of joke, but when they had, you know, Channel 4's top 100 comedians in the world, and when they first had the poll, I know it's rigged and all that, but nevertheless, I came 17th.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, well, I'm never going to come and don't deserve to come 17th in terms of top 100 authors, really, because I'm not. I think I'm better than 17th. I mean, I think I'm fucking a lot better than 17th. But, this is stand-up. I mean, whatever kind of arsake it gives me, which is tremendous, you know, it's really, you know, I still find it tremendously difficult in so many ways. I'm fucking good at it, you know.
There is something...
I'm really good. I'm really, really good.
There is something... I think with stand-up, part of the seductive quality of stand-up is that it allows you to remain unhappy whilst being successful. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
You can't be a happy stand-up. What's the point of that? It lets one kind of explore one's restlessness and ego, and I'm just, you know, it's an outlet that kind of, it's the gift that keeps on giving for someone who doesn't ever really want to be happy.
Yeah, and you have to go to Norwich or to do it,
Yeah.
You have to get on that, you know, get in that car, get on that fucking train. I'll fucking go there, you know. It's a nightmare. But it's hopefully creative discomfort, you know.
Creative discomfort. Yeah, that's a nice, that's a teachable, that's a masterclass. You talk about, in the book a bit about Linda needing to, or you needing Linda to reassure you that you'd been the best. After a variety of things, in the Young Ones, in, you know, whatever show, you know, The Secret Policeman.
I'm
always fascinated with that, with comedians who we see absolutely boss the room, like just completely take charge, channel all of that authority, all of that power, in your case that kind of attack and the kind of the chaos, the rhythm, all those things you do so brilliantly, then coming off stage and going, was that all right? and crucially, I think in your case, was I the best?
Yeah. I think one of the things that was good about when I came back in whenever it was, 2011, is that I'd lost some of that, really. That I didn't care about being the best anymore, really. I was happy with being good, really. Because there are so many comedians now that, you know, I don't know what being the best actually means, really. So the venues are getting, I think it's starting to grow in me again. The kind of megalomania is starting to. But for certainly when I first came back, I was perfectly happy to just say, I'm just another comic, and I do what I do.
And what's the effect on your creativity of that kind of mindset? Because I feel like sometimes unhappy comedians who are desperate to be the best have a huge amount of drive. And I often wonder, is that worth it? Do you know what I mean? Like making all this great work and achieving huge success and fame and everything. Is that worth the being unhappy? Like, would they rather have been happy?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the, you know, that's the human condition, isn't it, really? I mean, that's a question we all, you know, examine life and all that. But I think in terms of being a stand-up, I don't care about playing big rooms anymore, you know. If I wanted to, really, I think, like, I mean, this, oh, you, what's it, like 600 or something? I could, if I really, really wanted to, I could play, you know, the Apollos and the, you know, without too much effort, too many appearances on Loose Women or Sunday Brunch. I don't care about that. I mean, I'm often happiest doing museum comedy, which is where it's really the only place where.
Is that the little underground, like the corrugated tunnel? It's about 50-seater. Lovely.
And that's where I do all my work in progress. And I could quite easily, I think, just stay there. So I'm not having played. I've never played arenas, but the biggest places I've played was, you know, my pomp would have been like Liverpool Empire or something, which is 3,000, you know, Palladium. I can't, you know, so I'm not, so that urge to be bigger and bigger is not, you know, I'm not, I don't care about that anymore, really. I mean, the thing that has, I mean, surprised me, I suppose, and being a, come out of the blue, has been the imaginary sandwich bar, really. I mean, that's, I mean, I know the previous head of comedy at Radio 4 before Charlotte Williams took it over, I didn't really get on with, and she never, she was always kind of like turning, you know, people would pitch things with me in it, and she'd always turn them down, really. And Charlotte, you know, said as soon as she got the job that she wanted me to be on Radio 4. And so very quickly I did season one of Sandwich Bar, and I mean, I think I'm very lucky, just to, Joe Nunnery is the producer and director, really, and he's a marvellous foil for me. And, you know, season one did really well, season two did really well, and then season three just went fucking nuts, you know. And it's the, really massive, and it won like the, you know, all, you know, won the audio awards and all that stuff. And it's been and that's been that's, you know, that's ultimately, I mean, I just find that, I mean, it's very gratifying, but.
Imaginary Sandwich Bar, like with your column Great Bus Journeys of the World, they share that quality of being like a daft idea that's an opportunity to hang to a kind of collage whatever you want.
Yeah.
So when you're writing Sandwich Bar, is there, because anything's possible, is that harder because anything's possible, because there's no limitations on
what? No, it's really, I mean, it's really, I actually can never quite remember writing Sandwich Bar, that I just sort of, it sort of kind of appears almost, really, as if...
Go on.
I kind of sit in the... Well, I sit in... We've got, like, a conservatory on the back of our house now. I sit in there and then... kind of sandwich bar appears, really. It's like... It's... I mean, the way that I put that show together is I take stuff from all over. I take fiction that I've written and readapt it. I take old columns I've written and reformat them and stuff like that. And then I also use stand-up. I mean, there's most of the show that you will, you know, that you saw on Friday night, you will, you know, will eventually appear in, you know, next series four of Sandwich Bar. So it's a kind of mixture of, but it's an absolute joy to write, really. I don't, I mean, or it has been, at least. I mean, maybe now it's, you know, but I mean, matching the success of the last series might be a bit more dramatic, but no, it's just the, you know, it's only four, really, but you know, the format of it, really. I mean, like when I did my last TV series, it was my sixth TV series, Merry-Go-Round, and I really struggled to find stuff, because I think, again, I'd reached the end of, you know, of that period of my, and I had like five writers and stuff, and we really, you know, we struggled to find enough material to fill 6.5 hours. But by myself, just solely me, I can easily fill four half hours for Sandwich Bar.
It's funny, the two things I think must be the hardest things to write are stand-up, I know from experience, and novels. So having kind of done both of those, or having a good grounding in both of them, collaging from, you know, basically the opportunity to just look out of the window and kind of go, right, let this come out. That seems really joyous.
Yeah.
In terms of assembling your stand-up show that you're touring at the moment, obviously there are some bits there, there are kind of little anecdotal bits, and then there are some of the more kind of ferocious bits, which are more, you get back into... I wanted to ask you as well about your particular, I don't even know what the term is it scansion or attack or delivery or something? There's a sentence I read in Thatcher Stole My Trousers, where you're describing Adelaide as being like, as if a hallucinatory version of Stoke has been suddenly plonked in the middle of a botanical garden. And I read that sentence and I just heard it in the guy in the suit's voice.
Right.
You know, as if, I can't do the meter without doing an accent, as if Stoke had just been plonked in the botanical gardens. that kind of meter and that delivery, that kind of still sort of flashes out of you. It's like there's that gear that's still there. So when you build the show that you're on tour with, mm-hmm. you said it was built in kind of from literary festivals, but clearly bits of it are kind of still more kind of savage.
Well, that was the first. That was my first. I mean, I've essentially done, since 2011, 2012, I've essentially done three entire shows.
Really. Okay.
So the first one was Soho Theatre, and then Edinburgh Festival in 2013.
I saw the Soho one, yeah.
Yeah. And then the second one was, I guess, Soho, Edinburgh in 2017. And then this is kind of the third one. Now, I'm not like Stuart, where I'd throw everything out and start again. So there are bits, not much, but there's bits of material that were in the 2013 show, gags. Although they tend to mutate into... Yeah, you kind of take the bare bones and then rebuild it, really. So that but there are lines that are the same. But as I said, I've forgotten what I'm talking about. But then, so this is kind of the third show that I've done, really. I've forgotten what the question was.
Well, I suppose I'm just asking about, like, do you ever find yourself with a blank page in front of you going, right, I'm going to write a new bit? Or is it all that it grows on anecdotal stuff you said? I mean, what is your write when you write a stand-up show?
Right.
What does it look like from scratch? Is it?
Well, I keep a notebook, obviously, like 101. So although it doesn't have as much in it as it used to. So when I was writing it, the way that I do it physically, and I think it's important for me to not do it on a computer, really, because I think that. It just kind of, there's something about, obviously writing novels or memoir, it's fine on the computer. So I have like a Ryman's pad, A4 pad. This is fetishism, but I mean, it's margin, folds from the top.
Yeah.
And it's got, two holes, at the side.
Okay, yeah.
And I always use the same pad. And then I... write out not a script but headline the show gradually put write out the show from ideas or scraps and stuff, so it'll be in Biro, it has to be in black Biro, and now that'll be about 2 pages long, and then I'll do that to Linda in the conservatory. I call it, pretentiously call it the studio. And the cat, Wilf the cat, comes as well. So I'll then perform it to Linda. I'll say...
Just tell me about that, the performance. How performed is it?
It's not super performed. Chatted through more or less, I think. I will then do that. And then from that, I will then boil it down to 10... headlines that I write on a card. So it'll say like that show you saw last night. It'll say like Hirohito because of, eating, betting, the themes, health, which is, this is a 10 minute bit about, but that I just have that word health. And then that's the kind of the running order. That's how I do it, really. I think it's very important to physically, and then I actually do that with marker pens on kind of big sheets of card. I think it's really important, it feels really important to have that physical interaction with pen and paper.
Yeah, right.
To put it together. That's physically how I do it, really. Go through it with Linda and Ria. For the first show, like 2013 and 2017, we rehearsed a lot more. I mean, now I've got it down, so I don't do it much to Linda, really, because I know what's going to work and what doesn't, so I put it together, and then I go to the Museum of Comedy. I book like a week or something there. And, run it.
Do you ever work with a director, or like an outside eye?
Linda's the director.
Just a couple of listener questions to wrap up. Is there anyone current? This is Stuart Robin says. Is there anyone current that he really admires?
Stuart. I mean, he's not that.
No, like current. I mean, like you mentioned Fern Brady. That kind
of I think she's got. She could be. She's still got a ways to go, but I mean, she's got an amazing backstory. And Kai Samra, I think, is I like a lot.
Yeah, okay. I'm not saying.
Again, he's got a really interesting backstory. That he was, you know. Okay. I mean, you are getting those people now. I forgot that, like Finn, and like, you know, he's homeless and stuff. Got these really had these really interesting lives.
Yeah.
If they can do good stuff about it, then you know. Who else? I quite like these. Seems to what's he called, George Washington or something.
Oh,
Chris Washington.
Chris Washington. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where he's kind of. I mean, I quite like when I saw him in Soho. I'm starting to get to know a lot of younger comics now. Young, I mean, they're not that young. People like Phil Ellis and stuff like that. Yeah. I think it's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, a great offstage, amazing raconteur, I think.
Incredible. He is watching him compare somewhere like the Frog and Bucket in Manchester, right, which I find rowdy.
Yeah.
And watching him compare it by being silly and kind of take control with silliness and his frankly ludicrous body. Do you know what I mean? But like making the most use of it. It's really amazing to see someone.
Yeah. I mean, I got me and Joe, my producer, we go and see something at the Soho once every couple of months or something. Mm. And I'm just guided by him, really. But so, there's a lot of people with, seems like there's a lot of people with a lot of, and also it's a bit nepotistic, but I like Peter Richardson's son, Red.
He's great.
I think he's great, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not the finished article yet, but
you were talking on stage about sons of alternative children of alternative comics, and I sat in the audience making a list of all the ones I could pick up.
Millions, but Red is one of the better ones.
I
like Red. He's a nice, you know, I'm fond of him, really. Known him since he was born, and I mean, it's also true that Alfie Brown,
Listener question from Bennett Thorpe. He says, I mean, it's not a question, but 25 years ago, he was on TV simultaneously in Alexi Sales Stuff, the James Bond he did, and an advert on the other channel. Three channels at once, and there was only four channels. He was basically, for 30 seconds, as famous as the Queen.
Yeah, it wasn't... It wasn't Bond, was it? It was Indiana Jones. And I never appeared in an advert. It was a voiceover.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Apart from that, yes.
Yeah. Clock in that moment.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing. I mean, it's funny. It feels like, I mean, I often think about all that, really. It was I didn't really stop and think. I mean, it was, there was a while there when, you know, we were massive, you know. Me and you know, the people I knew, we were huge. And I think we were lucky in a way that, you know, it sort of didn't... Yeah, you get a table at the Ivy or something, but it didn't... You get invited, but it wasn't, you know... That didn't drive any of us mad. That particular thing did not drive us mad, though.
John Bai says, how is Alexi enjoying / dealing with the transition from counterculture to National Treasure?
Quite well, yeah, I don't mind, yeah. I mean, it is, you know, you gotta, as long as it doesn't affect what I do, really, so I kind of like, I mean, I love all that young comics feeling they have to pretend to revere me. I think that's...
But they are obviously a lot of them totally revere me.
Yeah, some of them, most of them do, but there's supposed to be the odd one that's going, it's this cunt. I mean, I love all that. I don't have a problem with it. I think I've earned it, you know, and it's not like I'm doing the fucking Royal Variety performance or anything, you know. It's fine. I don't mind.
You just reminded me of that description in the book of the original Comedy Store kind of scene being people who would love to People who would be so excited, people who dream about...
Pauline's line, yeah.
Yeah, their Pauline's line, yeah.
She said, for the people who dream about refusing to go on the rubber ride. yeah, brilliant fucking line, yeah.
Chris Terry says, my wife met him years ago, as she remembers. She knocked on his door as a brownie selling a charity thing. He told her to fuck off and shut the door. And then he opened it again and said it was a joke.
I mean,
does that feel like the sort of thing you'd have done?
I don't know. I try and be polite to people, you know. I think it's important to be mannerly. So I can't say I would have been nasty to a girl guide. But, it's a bit Hitler youthy, isn't it, girl guide? Maybe I thought she was...
Last question then. I forget which list of this was from. Did you get any grief from Disney for singing the Mickey Mouse theme tune in the credits of Stuff? Because whenever I think your name, I think A-L-E-X-E-I.
I think that... I used to do a routine about this. Now I think they must have cleared it with, okay, you know, legally. But they did... When we did... And again, in my first show, I did a bit about it. When we did Snow White and the Seven Samurai in Series 1 of Stuff, Disney issued a writ, and me and David Nanjo and Marcus Mortimer, the producer director, went to see the BBC barrister, and she said, fuck Disney, we're the BBC. She said, which I just thought was the most, I can't imagine the BBC doing that, having the confidence to do that now. I just thought, fuck yeah, we're the BBC, you know, we're the fucking BBC. We don't, you know, sadly a much diminished organisation since then, kind of lost its nerve, but I think that fuck Disney, we're the BBC. So, and they just backed down, you know.
Very finally then, did you become the great artist that you always set out to be?
No, I can't. There's nothing like art school for putting you off art, really. So I never, and I wasn't good enough. Again, I found, you know, the best thing that I can do is be a stand-up, you know. I'm really, really good stand-up, and that's like, you know, why would you want to be anything else, really?
So that was Alexei Sale. Thank you so much to Alexei for coming on the show. Thanks to his PR people for helping me sort that out. Thanks to Ellen Frost and everyone at the Bloomsbury Theatre who gave us the recording space. And do rush and see Alexei Sale on tour now. www.alexeisayle.me. So alexeisayle.me for all of his tour tickets. He is coming to the Bloomsbury Theatre. I suspect it's sold out, but if you're quick, you might get something there. So this is a little thing from Simon, who is a listener to the show. Early this month, he says, you asked for anyone who'd achieved something thanks to ComComPod. This is my little story. Simon says, in September of last year, I was decorating my conservatory while listening to you interview Ellie Taylor. I'd seen Ellie earlier in 2019, having been a fan for a long time, and she didn't let us down with a brilliant gig. When you were interviewing her, it helped me see how she came up with material. That's seen fine when I read it the first time. And I thought, I've been thinking about doing a stand-up course for ages. Ellie has showed us her insecurities and is brilliant. So get on and book it. He goes on, I asked on the Facebook group, that's the ComCom Facebook group, one of the nicest places on the internet, for a course in Birmingham, and many people recommended James Cook's course. Well, as of 9 p.m. last night, I've performed 5 minutes of my own original material and got laughs. I even had the terror of someone in the front row getting a phone call, which I managed to deal with and get a laugh. I'm planning on keeping this going, he says, not with the intention of making a career out of it, because I really enjoyed the process of writing, collaborating with other comics and performing it and getting plenty of laughs. Even if I don't do anything else, I feel like I've gotten a glimpse into how hard you have to work to mine the funny, giving me even more respect for all comedians. ComComPod is literally integral to this whole story, so thank you. Well, thank you, Simon, and a pat on the back there for James Cook, who is an excellent comic friend of mine and terrifyingly well-researched board game enthusiast. So, great. I mean, look, that's a recommendation for James's course. That's also a recommendation for believing in yourself. And I'm a particular fan of how Simon said, I'm going to keep going, not to make a career out of it, but just because I enjoyed all the elements. Well, that's what it's all about. So thanks to Simon for getting in touch. I will post Amble at you in just a second. Thank you to Alexei. Thanks to Tom Wateracre, to Ellen Frost. Music was by Rob Smout, and podcast consultant was Peter Dobbing. The logs were done by Jake Crossland. And your editor and producer, as ever, was the very capable Nathan Wood. That's all of that. However, here's a tiny announcement. This is a soft launch. I believe you can now buy tickets for my Edinburgh Fringe show. It's got a title. It's called The Void. I've said that out loud now. I've committed to it. The poster is literally the best poster I've ever had. The image for the poster, I am so, so excited about it. My dear friend and brilliant professional photographer, Andre Pattenden, made this incredible image happen. And everyone I show it to physically takes a step back and says, wow, out loud. I can't wait to show you that. It's under wraps for now, but the show is called The Void, and you can buy tickets for it at... And this is one of those moments when I should have found out where you can buy tickets for it. I'm going to guess Monkey Barrel. Stuart, there we go. Let's keep this live live moment of trying to find out how to... What is that? Is that it? Is that it there? This is me demonstrating how to find it. I've typed in Monkey Barrel Stuart Goldsmith 2020 to see what would happen. And we've landed on event.bookitbe.com/26738/Stuart-Goldsmith-Fringe-2020. The tickets are available there, my friends, and I will probably condense that into some sort of bit.ly link and whack it in the biog at ComComPod or indeed at Stu Goldsmith on all various forms of social media. So that wasn't, I mean, I said it was a soft launch and it was pretty incredibly soft. The point is you can get tickets. They cost some money. How much do they cost? I'll click on one. They cost, £6 plus 69p in fees. Cheeky. It's on at Monkey Barrel 1 at 10 past 3 every day throughout the Fringe. I say every day from Tuesday the 6th, if yellow means that there's a show then, Thursday the 6th. Christ, this is awful. Until Sunday the 30th. It's not on Thursday the 20th. Do you know what this means, guys? It's going to be spreadsheet day pretty soon. Not soon. What is it? It's only just March, isn't it? Let's give it a month or two, but start assembling your spreadsheets, but don't fill them in ink, because we're going to do something in the ComCom Facebook group and we're going to share our spreadsheets. And it's just the most efficient way to build your brilliant, wonderful and surprising Edinburgh Fringe timetable. So there we go. As soft launches go, I mean, that was... It had sort of evaporated by the time it came out. The point being, tickets are on sale. You'll have to Google them to find them. There's no immediately zappy link, but I'll make one. And there we go. The show's called The Void. I'm working with a very excellent director, and I will tell you more about that and they in due course. And that's all of that. I would love to do you a postamble. Here's a micro postamble, right? I'm in Cape Town. I'm in a festival. I recorded an incredible episode yesterday with Desiree Birch. She talks so fast. We've got 4 hours of content in a two-hour episode, so it might even be a two-parter. It's incredible, and she's wonderful. I'm here with some brilliant South African comics. C.C. Chimura was on the opening gala. He was great. Prince was fantastic. I'm struggling now to remember the names. Mo Jack and Mo compared brilliantly well. There was a guy called Bongani whose surname I don't remember, which is very rude of me, but he's one of those guys who swaggered around backstage like he was a killer and then turned out to be a killer. So well done, Bongani. We're also working with Alonzo Bodden, who I'm hoping to record with soon, a fabulous American comic. And there's just such a lovely group of people here. I'm hosting a show in a 1,400-seater venue every night, and I get to come up through a hatch in the floor at the beginning of the show. Oh, God, that is an absolute... I mean, it was only last week I was in Cambridge and balancing up on the sort of gritty thing. Have I even done a sort of post-tour post-amble? I don't think I have. It was so great. Cambridge was a fabulous way to finish it off. And it's so lovely. And I'm already on to the next thing. It just kind of, it goes on forever, the tour. And then before you know it, it's suddenly over and you're on to the next thing, The Void. So the end of tour in Cambridge had a good chunk of stuff that will become The Void in the second half of it. It was great fun to watch. And thank you, everyone that got in touch with me, for your feedback on that, which I requested. My point is, I'm having a wonderful time here. It's such a brilliant lineup. Sindhu V, Fern Brady, Laura Davis, Deliso Chaponda, all of this parish. Nick Rabinowitz, a brilliant local South African act. And also, I feel like there's a guy. Oh, Phil Nickel. My God, absolutely. There we go. Phil Nickel and me. That's one show. And then there's the Danger Zone with terrifying, dangerous acts such as Spencer Jones. And also Finn Taylor, Jeff Innocent. Who else is on it? Desiree. Come on, remember everyone. Robbie Collin. I'm going to go and see it tonight. I can't wait. Everyone's been telling me how good Robbie Collin is. He's another South African act. And I think that's everyone, but I can't possibly... Fuck God, this has gone on. This has just become a ramble because I'm so desperately afraid of missing someone off accidentally. I feel like that can't be everyone. Jeff, Spencer, Alonso's hosting, Finn, Robbie. Have I said everyone? God, this is the single thing I find most distressing, most stressful about podcasting is the... Like, what I'm going to do... is you're going to end up with me, like, Nathan's going to have to work through the night to chop in a last-minute remembered edit where I go, oh, obviously my best friend, mentor and guy who saved my life is the other act on the bill. But at the moment, anyone's name escapes me. Right, the point is, great shows here, fantastic people. I'm going on a very friendly safari. I was saying that always makes you think of guns. There's no guns involved. And we're being very well looked after. So thank you to Sam and Jade and Anna and Annika and Dan and all of those people. I'm having a wonderful time. I'm going to get back to having a wonderful time. I'm going to go and drink some coffee. I've been up since five for this TV press call thing this morning, and I'm slightly losing my mind. But also, big shout out to my wife, who is doing double parenting at the moment while I gad about. And I love you very much. And I hope that, A, I hope you're bothering to listen to this. And B, if you are, I hope you know how grateful I am that you are doing the real work while I'm fannying around looking at a monkey. All right. Love you. Love the rest of you. Bye for now. But less. I love the rest of you less, like considerably. Like, I love you, but let's say the other way around. I love my wife more.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.